I woke up this morning realizing that after preaching for 46 years and retiring in, June or July of 2016, it's the first time I've spoken in a sermon in almost 2 years. Oh, wow. I almost thought I forgot how to do it. So I chose Hebrews 11 for a special reason. I want very much for people to understand not what faith means in terms of trying to find a definition for it or an explanation for it, but how faith becomes something that's truly observed. How many of you believe in science? Don't all of you believe in science, right? But how many of you also believe in miracles? Now, you know that science can never explain the miracle. It can only acknowledge that a miracle has taken place. And that's the same thing that's true about faith. Faith isn't just a series of beliefs or a certain series of creeds. Faith is more observed as a reality. It's just like saying that creation can't explain the Creator, right? It's like we human beings can't fully explain God. God can explain creation. And if you look at the text particularly I'm about to read in a few minutes, you recognize that in the beginning, God, Genesis 1:1, Bereshith bara Elohim v'hashamayim v'ha'aretz, in the beginning, God created. And what it seems to imply is that there was nothing there until God spoke it into existence. So creation can't explain God. God created. And now God begins to explain his creation and its goodness to us. In the same way that in our own experience with God, we rely on the past to give us clarity as to what the present means. How many of you know that? How many of you heard, we got new truths today, new ideas about what to believe in? They're not new. In fact, the only way that a new thing becomes viable and believable is because it's linked to the past truth that never changes. And so when we talk about faith, that's what we mean to talk about. We talk about how we've observed faith in the past. And that's why the writer of Hebrews took the time to kind of recite that. Now, I wish we had the time to actually all of us together read the entire chapter 11 and 12. But you have, how many of you are on internet? You have access. You can find all this stuff, but you've got to read it to be able to understand it. So I'm not going to take the time to read all that, and we'll put a couple of PowerPoints to kind of guide you in the conversation. But if you take the first three verses of Hebrews chapter 11, this is what you read. Now, I'm trying to make sure that I have the same. What if I just turned and read it from here? Because I don't think I have the same translation. Okay? Now, faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. In other words, faith is expressed and realized by the confidence and the assurance of things we don't really tangibly see. That's faith. And this was what the ancients were commended for. By faith, we understand that the universe was formed at God's command. So what is seen was not made out of what was visible. In other words, you view something that really wasn't visible before. That's the reality. That's what faith is. Maybe I can illustrate it this way. How many of you have ever been given a promise? And then you waited for the promise to be fulfilled, right? You got a promise, you hope that the promise will come. How many of you ever heard Proverbs, I think it's Proverbs, what is it? Proverbs 13:12. Hope deferred makes the heart sick, right? If you have a promise and you hope it happens, and it doesn't happen, you get kind of sick. Or if it takes too long, you get sick of worrying about that. I just moved from California about a year ago. So it was the first time I did my taxes. And I, for 20-some years, I had my secretary, who was an accountant, do my taxes. So I didn't, you know, I just gave her all the information. You know, she said, TurboTax is great. So I thought, well, I'll try TurboTax for the first time. And it was great. Oh, my gosh. Put in the information, and all the information comes out. I got the sign from TurboTax on my computer. It says, and they'll let you know when you get your refund. Right? So I'm waiting, and all of a sudden, oh, gosh, my federal tax came in exactly the way it said, the amount, and it's been deposited in your account. Woo! And then it said, and the same thing will do with your state taxes. I didn't have to pay California tax, so that was okay, but I had this check coming from the Oregon out of my retirement taxation guy. I thought, this is great. I can't wait. And it's hope. It's coming. Right? Weeks went by. Oh, my gosh. Then I get a letter in the mail. You need to fill out this form. I said, okay. Fill out the form, mailed it back in. I thought, okay, mail to Salem, Oregon with the IRS. Weeks went by. I started getting sick. Oh, my gosh. After about a month and a half of waiting for this check to come in the mail and not getting any information from TurboTax that it was there, I lost all hope. I said, okay, no big deal. I mean, it's only a, well, it was quite a few dollars, but I thought, okay, I'll just deal with that. You know, I've been disappointed before. I've been hopeless before. And I thought, well, you know what? I think maybe I should just, I hadn't checked my account in a couple of months, and so I went on the house, and lo and behold, it was deposited but never told. And all of a sudden, my hope just kind of went up again. I didn't notice it was actually in my bank account without knowing that. That's the nature of realizing a hope. Now, the reality was, in Hebrews 11, what you get is this, that many people were made a promise. Even when you go, and this is the first slide, and you go to the ancients, and the ancients in the text of Hebrews are Abel and Enoch and, what do I have here, Noah? Yeah. And so, in other words, Abel, how many of you remember the story of Cain and Abel? You know, Abel's offering was accepted by God, but Cain's wasn't? Now, we can't quite understand that context because context changed from one generation to the next. But we do know this, that Abel was commended for recognizing there was a God to give this offering to and to give it with the right attitude and the right spirit. So he was a person who demonstrated faith. The same is with Enoch, who was and no longer was. Nobody knew where he died. He just vanished into eternity. We all know the story of Noah, right? Noah lived in a godless age, and God said, build an ark, because I'm going to do this. And if you do this, then you build a ark, then you'll be saved. Everybody will perish. And so what did Noah do? Built an ark. You ever read the story about the size of this thing? And then the story about how he had to, what, invite all the animals, two of a kind, into this thing? And so you look at Noah and you say, the ancients, by faith, were commended because they believed in the promises even though they didn't experience the promise. It was not fulfilled for them. It was something way out there. But nonetheless, God said, by faith, they demonstrated what it is to have faith in the existing God. Now, if that isn't enough, then you look at the recent past. And by recent past, not recent past in terms of Hebrew, but recent past in terms of Hebrews, who were the writer of Hebrews, which was, again, the patriarch Abraham. Remember, you know, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, all those persons? And they're commended for having their faith, even though they didn't realize the fullness of their faith, fullness of the promise that was given to them. Remember Abraham? God said, hey, Abe, let's go over here. And Abraham did that. Remember Abraham, 100 years old, and his wife Sarah, you know, and God says, you're going to be the father of a great nation. Wait a minute, God. We don't even have a child. And if the text is correct, my wife's almost dead in terms of childbearing. And hey, I'm 100 years old, you know. But Abraham believed a promise he thought he heard from God. But it's even worse, remember? She got a child, named him Isaac. And guess what Abraham thinks God's telling him to do? Take your child up to Mount Moriah, and you're going to sacrifice him. Now, I don't know about you, but Abraham's 100 years old, has a son. I'm going to take this son up to this mountain, and I'm going to sacrifice him like all the other animal sacrifices I've ever done in my life. So the text says that as far as Abraham was concerned, Isaac was as good as dead, right? He prepared to kill his own son because he believed in the promise of God, even though it was all contrary in terms of its appearance. But the moment that he was about to put the sword to his son, God said, I will provide the sacrifice. Do you understand that even with Abraham and Sarah and Abraham and Isaac, those are resurrection stories? They were just as good as dead. It's almost in some way a preparatory for what God is going to do. See? So not only the ancient past, but the recent past exercised faith because they believed that God was talking to him and telling him to do it, and they did it even though they didn't get the results or the effect of what they were promised. Now the writer of Hebrews moves not just to the ancient past, the recent past, but now we're talking about Samson and all those people there who put their faith in this God. And then now we move to the time of the disciples. And this is what I call almost the recent past, the recent past, almost the present in terms of the writer of Hebrews. And now he plays out the story of all those who died for their faith, who were persecuted. I mean, you can read the book. You can know all the things that occurred in that reality. And if you recall, if you read the New Testament, recognize that, again, here, even persons like Lazarus and Dorcas, Lazarus was deader than dead. And God raised him from the dead. Dorcas was dead, but God raised him from the dead. Why? Because these had faith to believe in the God who could do what he promised he would do. Now, the incredible miracle of the New Testament church was they not only believed that God would do it, but they had the view that God did what he said he would do. He came himself, lived out right there among them, did the incredible, miraculous things that nobody else could do. All the things that God could do, God began to do through this, well, to himself, through Jesus the Christ himself. The same Christ that the writer of Hebrews knew was crucified on the cross. And yet God promised that he would raise us from the dead. And he began by raising himself from the dead. You see, so faith, our faith is a result of our observation and the history of people who had faith before us. And so we're asked by the writer of Hebrews, because God commended these who didn't see the result of the promise, and now for those who have seen the promise in Jesus Christ, he says, for those of you who believe and have faith, but do not see. Remember Thomas? I won't believe until I see him. And Jesus said after Thomas saw him, hey, I'm glad you believed, but blessed are those who believe without seeing. And now what we have has begun to be the premise of faith. So us today, I'm sorry, I'm probably going faster than so us today, we believe in the present promise of God towards the promise yet to come, right? What's the promise yet to come? Guess what? He's coming back. He's coming back. And so we live in this incredible between time of knowing he came, even though we didn't personally see him. We have the history and the record of him coming. And so we live in this awkward time of knowing God has fulfilled his promise and God is going to fulfill his promise ultimately. Now here is where the book, the chapter, beginning in chapter 12, takes a turn. Because if you read chapter 12, you begin to say, oh my. We're in this in-between time, and chapter 12 talks about enduring hardship, about persevering. And we're saying to ourselves, oh, wait a minute here. Why? He's come. I believe he's coming. He's coming again. Why does my life have to be filled with struggle, with endurance, with perseverance? You ever stop thinking about that? Why don't we just climb on this Christian magic carpet and just everything is fine, hunky-dory? Why do we have to deal with this other kind? I've often asked myself why. Because chapter 12 talks about the discipline of God and that God disciplines those he loves. How many of you like to be disciplined? And yet it says that God disciplining us is his way of commending our faith. It's his way of saying, you trust me, you believe in me, which means whatever you endure or experience, you do because you believe me, because you trust me, because you have faith in me. How many of you know that being a Christian is not the easiest thing in the world? Not in these days. Christianity has sold down the river as some whatever. How many of you know how hard it is to even stand and make a proclamation without in some way getting pushed back? I've often asked myself, why, God? I have faith, and I'm absolutely certain that when this life is over, I know exactly where I'll be because I believe in the promise of God. That never ever causes me some anxiety. Now this present life, it's a little different, right? Because I'm holding on to this hope. I know it's there, and I'm supposed to have it here. But how does it play out here, in ways that maybe seem incongruent to the whole reality of faith? You see, if faith is believing promises and hoping that those promises are realized, then something of this life of faith we call becomes the proof and observation of just that. And so I'm going to close. It's okay. It's kind of a short sermon. Is that okay? I haven't done this in a while. So let me tell you two little illustrations, okay? I became a Christian when I was 12 years old. My dad was stationed on the island of Guam mid-1958 to 1960. 12 years old. Maybe some of you are as old as I am. Billy Graham's first film was Oiltown, USA. Right? My family came to Christ seeing the film Oiltown USA. We all walked up on the island of Guam with Church of God missionaries there and gave our heart to Jesus. It's a great day. 12 years old, I got the guarantee of heaven. Ah. But at 12 years old, you don't think about much about the hope of eternity. You think about current hopes, right? Now, the only hope that a 12-year-old, well, I'm going to say 12, the only hope that I had was that I could make the All-Star team, the Little League All-Star team, and compete for the Little Leagues. Now, lo and behold, by God's grace, I was. And I'm not graduate. I was the best player on the team. I was the pitcher, the shortstop, and I was looking forward to going. At 12 years old, having received Christ, I believe that God will fulfill the hope that I had. How many of you did that? Right? Give your heart to Jesus. 2 weeks before my team was to, a month before, because it took some while. A month before my team, was to leave the island of Guam and fly to Japan to compete in the Far East Regionals of the Little League World Series, my dad got orders to move to Oklahoma. I'm 12 years old. God? He made promises. I think he made promises. He promised me to do for real. I want, that's what I want. I boarded the plane as we flew out in tears. Because God didn't work out quite the way I wanted him to work out with my 12-year-old dreams. But here's the truth. 28 years later, I took my family to the island of Guam, serve as a missionary for 3 years, and was privileged to have Val and Lisa as youth members and help disciple them into who they become. Sometimes our hopes are so small compared to the hopes that God has for us. Sometimes what we have to endure in this life, because we have this hope, this faith, this confidence in God, sometimes it means disappointments in our own little prideful hopes. Because being a Christian doesn't mean that life gets easy. It doesn't mean that you get everything you want for your own sense of pleasure. It means you hold on to the hope that God is sovereign and God's promises are true, and amen. Right? So I'll share one final story. This is kind of personal, but that's why I'm here, right? I think it was 5 years ago I found out I was a diabetic. I just had prostate surgery, took a trip to China, and with that prostate surgery, my surgeon came to me after the surgery and said, "Didn't you know you had diabetes?" I said, "Well, you're the classic stereotype, Asian, whatever, you know." I remember after I came back from a quick trip where I felt the difficulty of blood clots because of the surgery, and I was alone with God. How many of you have conversations with God in your head? It's like this whole conversation going. And I said to him, "I'm not happy with you. That you would let me. I think I took fairly good care of my body. I think I did everything I could. That you would let me get diabetes." Now, in case you don't know, diabetes is a difficult, difficult challenge for a person to go. Not just diet and exercise, but medication. I take insulin twice a day. I average walking. What am I average walking? This past week, I walked 50 miles. It's just the routine. But I remember just getting upset with God that he would let this happen to me. Good and faithful servant with all the faith in the world for him. And then I read chapter 12. And this is what I understand about the discipline of God. The discipline of God isn't just the discipline that comes in the punitive form for us doing things wrong. How many of you know? How many of you know that pain is God's megaphone? You do something wrong, so you don't do it again, right? But discipline is more than just a punitive thing for something you've done wrong. Sometimes discipline is what God wants you to learn so you can be who you're meant to be. And so you take a hold of this thing. And by faith, you enact the discipline you need to be who God's called you to be. I think that one of the biggest things that is in need for today's church is the discipline to be a disciple of Jesus Christ. To take all of what it means to be a disciple, to model the life and the person of Jesus Christ in your life, and to so manage yourself, your mind, body, and your soul, by the help of God, to be that for him. I'll close with this one more. I have a couple of surprises. How many of you know that sometimes when you think about going to heaven, you just think, I hope so-and-so's not there. You ever thought that? You ever thought that? Because if they're there, what? You're here? Ever thought that? Ever had those angular relationships in your life where you just, I wish they'd be there. I don't think they'll be there. Here's what I've learned. You get to heaven and you see the person you don't think should be there because of what they've done to you or you've done to them. And you see them. And oh my gosh, you're surprised. And the voice of God says to you, this is the person they were always meant to be. I meant them to be this in life itself. But they resisted or are challenged. And you met them in a moment when they weren't who they're meant to be. Now you get to see them for who they're meant to be. In the eyes of God, the person they've always been meant to be. Listen to me carefully. The person you've had the hardest time in this life, who you've cast away and rejected, who in some way have found faith in God and arrived at the same place that you arrived, at the hope of God in eternity. And you see them. And God says, it's too bad you didn't see them for the person they were meant to be, because now you get to see them for the person they're meant to be. And aren't you excited they're at? I am. Now, conversely, here's the other side of it. Having faith in God and trusting in the promises given to you to realize the hope is the challenge for you to be the person God means you to be now. Now. And if you're not making the effort to be the person that God wants and means you to be, then you're not quite living by faith. Abraham, go. But God, where am I going? Hey, Abraham, I have the itinerary. You don't. Go. Right? So by faith means that we accept and participate in the discipline that's required for us to be the person God wants and means us to be as best in this life. So the ultimate hope is that we are in that life. I didn't mean to say this. I've asked myself this question more since I've moved to Oregon. And that is, what am I doing here? I'm serious, you know. I'm 40 years in the ministry, I've been all over the world. I wake up sometimes in the morning not knowing what I'm supposed to do because I'm retired. And I'm just saying, I don't say this just to make you nostalgic, but every morning I remind myself, I'm here for them. I'm here to be the person I'm supposed to be for my grandkids. And I'll do everything I can to be the kind of person that can do that for them. Now, I do it for my kids too. I do it for the people around me too. Maybe I'll share this last illustration before we do a little ministry time. Maxine and I work out twice a week. what's Conestoga, what is it called? Community Center, Rec Center. That's Tuesday and Thursday mornings from 9:30 to 11. And she jumps in the pool, which I'm thinking, that's not working out. I mean, working out. So I go to the fitness center and I do 3.5 miles on the elliptical. I do 150 crunches. I do all kinds of things because that's part of what I have to do. So I watch this young gal come in the same time I do the same routine. She's probably in her early 30s or whatever. And I just thought, well, I just ask her, why do you do this? Why do you do this? Why do you push yourself? I'm asking myself, why do I push myself like this? 125 crunching, why? So I said to her, why do you do this? She said, well, I do it to help my core muscles. I said, yeah, I understand that. But she said, I really do it for my two kids. So I can carry them. And then I said to them, I do it for my grandkids. And we gave each other a high five. Right on. You see, faith is being and doing what your faith in Him requires to realize the hope He's established for you.